Welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
That's why we're about to talk about exclusively magazines and newspapers.
That's right, we just finished with books. Books suck!
Forget books!
Everything's on the internet now.
Including books.
That's right, tune in next week for our new YouTube podcast.
Watch all the YouTube sensations.
We're just gonna analyze stupid fucking YouTube videos.
That sounds incredible.
Actually, if someone hasn't done that, it probably could be a thing.
Yeah, probably.
Pitch that to the Minerva board.
Scott and I were just watching the horrible Montgomery flea market commercial from like a decade ago before you called me.
Amazing. So we are part of the Minerva Podcast Network, by the way.
We are. We're part of Minerva Magazine. Find at www.minervamag.com. We have a total of 4 podcasts that are all delightful, and I have appeared in all of them at some point. So if you just really like my voice for some reason, you'll listen to some more of those.
The Gabs Podcast Network.
Yeah, basically. Basically, like, my goal in life is to make a living doing nothing but recording stupid podcasts 24/7, so.
Man, if only it paid.
Yeah, I know.
Right. So without further ado, here is part 2 of the giant publishing megapod. Magazines and newspapers seem to be dead and or dying. Is that even true, or is it just one of those things that gets said a lot because, you know, internet?
Yeah. So they're definitely struggling. Newspapers and magazines are no longer in their heyday. So, like, compared to 2 years ago, like, that's very true that they are not as healthy, for sure. I would say newspapers, as far as I can tell, are doing worse than magazines.
Oh, really?
Print newspapers are probably gonna die. I guess, like, that's not really for me to say,
right.
But I will say that, like, even the New York Times, which is, like, the newspaper, is struggling. I subscribed to it briefly for a class last year, and I still occasionally, get letters from them where they're like, we will slash your subscription fee to like this ridiculously low amount. I mean, they're desperate for people to subscribe to the print copies. As far as I know, though, like, their online wing is doing well. They charge like a pretty reasonable fee for you to read unlimited articles for the Times. And so I really think, like, the struggle newspapers have is, like, they want to be relevant online with, like, all this other, you know, shit around. I personally think, like, quality journalism is important enough that, like, newspapers are never going to go away, but I could definitely see print newspapers basically becoming obsolete and then being entirely online. Entities, that's the word I'm looking for.
I mean, we all have our phones all the time.
Yeah, and unlike books, which, like, can be, like, a really nice quality or nice design, and this is, like, not a diss on newspapers, but, like, newspapers are printed on, like, you know, they're not great quality, they have to get designed very quickly, it's, like, you don't usually keep newspapers unless, like,
right,
you want to keep, like, the Royals winning the World Series, like, headline page or something. So there's not really that argument of, like, you know, no one's like, oh, no, I really want my print newspaper to take on the T and awkwardly try to read while there are thousands of people, like, smushed in around me. They're like, oh, no, I'm going to pull the Times up on my phone while I'm squished into my tiny corner, and that's
right.
Great. That was my favorite part of my New York Times subscription, was my online my digital subscription, and like one day when I am an adult with a job and money again, like I'm actually probably gonna subscribe to them digitally, but not their print version. As far as magazines go, they're doing okay. The big thing with magazines was, like, there was this huge magazine boom. We talked about this in my magazine class, where, like, basically everything in the entire frickin' world has a magazine for it. Like, you think of some weird, obscure niche, and, like,
I'm
there's, like, some...
of the Patton Oswalt piss drinkers bit right now.
Yeah. I mean, this... Yeah. So... But the thing we talked about was that there were, like, a gajillion magazines in print, and the really big thing that hurt the magazine industry was the recession in 2008, and basically, like, all the magazines that weren't, like, the Rolling Stone, like, level were like, yeah. Well, fuck, we can't afford to do anything, because no one is buying magazines during the recession, so tons of magazines folded. And I guess just the big problem that, like online magazines are doing well. There are a fair number of magazines that, like, are strictly online and don't even bother to try to have, like, a print faction. And then there are, of course, like, the really big ones that are not, like, as robust maybe as they used to be, but they're, like, not in danger of folding or anything. You'll notice, like, print magazines nowadays will have more ad pages than they used to because they need that to, like, pay for their stuff.
Right.
But they're not, like, on the verge of dying. And like, one of the things you talked about in my class was, like, the struggle that you have to, like, toe this line when you do a magazine, because you want to have, like, a really specific audience in mind. But then if that really specific audience is too small and you start a print magazine and then you don't have anywhere to go with it because there are only, like, 1,000 people in the world who, like, want to read about that,
right.
Then you can't maintain a print function. But you can do an online function, no problem. So... so, like, online magazines are doing fine. Digital versions of magazines, I don't know how many people read them, but, like, you know, that's a thing. But I think, whereas, like, print newspapers might die, I don't think magazines will. They're not, like, they're probably never going to return to, like, where they were, but they're not... At least in 2016, they're, like, not on the verge of death or anything.
Well, it certainly seems like the ones with the glossy photographs that are sitting in the checkout aisle are not going away anytime soon.
Oh, yeah, like, Us Weekly, yeah. And, like, all that shit. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was, like, just thinking of, like, of magazines. I wasn't even thinking of, like, tabloidy type stuff.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Or, like Time, I think, is America's most popular magazine, and okay. It's mostly, like, gossipy, and, like, people, or not Time,
People.
People, yeah. People love people! yeah.
All right, well, how about the online thing when it comes to... I guess mostly magazines is what I'm thinking of. You know, the, like, I loved Grantland when it was still running, which was basically an online magazine, even though that's not what they called themselves. And one of the things I liked about them, RIP Grantland, by the way, but one of the things...
Yeah, for real.
One of the things I liked about them is that they were, unlike the vast majority, from what I've seen at least, of at least, like, edited online publications, I don't know if that's the right word or not, but that they were allowed to write, like, a 6,000 or 8,000 word feature piece on something instead of the 2,000 word at most, make sure people will actually browse through most or all of the articles sort of thing. And, you know, their business model, either didn't work or their parent company wasn't willing to support them, depending on who you ask. But is that a thing that publishers are worried about? Is it harder to do the longer, more in-depth pieces now? What is kind of the, I guess, conventional wisdom is almost the wrong word because it hasn't been around that long, but the kind of insider view on producing internet content. And then I'd like to tack on the question, do you, like me, get tired of hearing every single thing online referred to as content?
Actually, content is just like the word that gets used so often that like it doesn't even register in my brain anymore. It's like, oh yeah, content, what's your content, whatever, like
it's like even, it's like said when you're writing dialogue.
Yeah, does not bother me at all. I think the big, so I don't think, oh wait, okay, sorry, I'm trying to decide like where I'm gonna start talking.
Yeah, I threw a bunch of stuff out there.
Okay, so I do think that there's, like, a ton more, like, stupid bullshit online than, like, you would find in a magazine, for example, than there used to be. Like, there is a ton of inane crap, excuse me.
A ton of inane crops.
online crop. I think that a lot of that longer, article stuff is still happening, but I think it's kind of just buried. It's like one of the things that I kind of wanted, that I was thinking about in terms of like long pieces versus short pieces, it's something we think about for Minerva. So like one of the reasons we started Minerva is we wanted people to be able to write like a thoughtful article, a long thoughtful article about something that you like might not see at another place. But at the same time, if you want people to come read your magazine, you can't do only long, in-depth pieces, because right, then, like, a certain number of people are going to be like, these are all too long. So you have to, like, the way we think of it is we, like, try to balance out the long pieces with, like, listicles or, like, a short little, like, goofy piece or something like that.
Well, to me, that makes, as a consumer, that makes sense to me, because I don't want every single thing I read to be the 6,000-word piece either. And to be fair, as a producer, I think, if you are putting that out there, only, like, the most brilliant piece is that's that long is going to actually get read all the way through by a large number of people.
Yeah, and so, like, I was thinking of websites like Jezebel or, like, Slate, stuff like that, where they have a ton of short pieces. You actually will find, like, really long, thoughtful, well-researched articles occasionally, like, pop up in places like that. And I think that those articles probably pop up about as much as they used to. I just think it's because online magazines demand that you produce a lot of content, and so, like, for example, for like Jezebel and Slate, we got to talk to some of the editors who worked there in my magazine class, and they were talking about, like, one of the things they have to do is update the site, like, I don't know, like 10, 15 times a day or something, because you want to make sure that someone doesn't check Slate in the morning and then check Slate in the evening and go, oh my god, there's nothing to do to read. This is bullshit. Because, like, the online, gosh, just like over here laughing. The online approach is just, that people expect things, like, a lot faster. So you can't produce, you know, the longer articles as quickly. You just have to be like, oh, someone shat themselves, quick, write about that.
Right.
just so, like, something's going up.
And five ways to kill time on the internet.
Yeah, and then you can, like, sprinkle in the longer, more thoughtful stuff. It's just that in order to, like, keep up with the pace of what readers expect, I think there's just, like, a lot more of that kind of stupid stuff. Granted, there are websites that are basically entirely dedicated to fucking bullshit.
Oh, sure.
And
ten hot athletes' wives.
Yeah, I sometimes get sucked into clicking on. There's a couple websites, and I'm not going to call them out because I don't want to get in trouble.
Right.
But there are a couple websites where I see things, and, like, all occasionally the headline is, like, a topic I'm so interested in, and I'll be like, every time I click on something by this website, I get disappointed because they're bullshit and I hate them, and I click on it anyway, and then, like, halfway through, I'm like, this is bullshit and I hate it, and then, like, So, I mean, that's definitely a thing, but...
Yeah. Well, you just defined clickbait.
Yeah, I mean, it just pisses me off because, like, sometimes... And this is, like, one of the reasons we created Minerva, is you'll see, like... I'm trying to think of the most recent one I clicked on, and I can't, but it was something... Like, they'll be like, oh, like, why women should wear lingerie. That's not something I would click on.
Right.
But, I don't know, like secrets in books you didn't realize. And I'll be like, oh, yeah, okay. And then it'll be like stupid bullshit.
Did you know that Harry Potter had a scar on his forehead?
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. That thanks for that secret.
God damn it. Why?
Good secret.
So then it's up to websites that don't do that could write something really interesting and thoughtful about it. And I just always, like, hope it will be clever, interesting, and thoughtful. I should really, like, start writing down all the articles I click on and then hate and then pitch them to Minerva to, like, have them written well.
There you go. I like that idea.
Maybe I'll start doing that.
I would love to do one of those. I'd love to do one of those a month or something.
Yeah. But I will also point out, if you were interested in a really long, thoughtful, well-researched, 6,000-word articles, read The New Yorker.
Hey, fair enough. Or The Atlantic, apparently.
Yeah. I don't read much of I have read some great stuff on The Atlantic. The New Yorker has, you know, sometimes it has pretension issues, but I will say they write freaking incredible profiles. And anytime I have clicked on, like, an 8,000-word profile from The New Yorker, I have never regretted reading
it. Right.
They're all fascinating. Highly, highly recommended. They did a great one on the Westboro Baptist Church.
Oh, yeah?
One of the... I think her name was Megan. I can't remember now. But she was running their Twitter. And it's basically about how, like, Twitter helped her start her journey of becoming disenchanted with the church and how she eventually, like, left Westboro and how she's, like, living, like, a secular life now. But it was... It was, like, one of the most interesting things I've ever read in my entire life.
That sounds interesting.
I highly recommend it.
All right. Well, that's... I mean, it's good to know. I mean, of course, I know there are some thoughtful, well-researched pieces. Or, I mean, hell, I don't even need it to be that well-researched if it's thoughtful and entertaining. But they tend to go hand in hand, I know.
I think it just feels... like, it's just overwhelming because there's so much fucking shit. Like we were talking about, you can have an online magazine and it basically doesn't cost you anything, but if you want to start a print magazine, you have to, like, really carefully plan it, get it funded, like, right. Everything. And so, because a bunch of dick balls are on the internet just doing stupid shit, it feels harder to find the good stuff, I think, online, but...
Yeah, so I'm thinking...
Editorial boards always have to, like, kind of do that dance of, like, well, you know, do we have enough stuff that's going to sell the magazine, or, like, that people are going to want to read, or do we have to, like, do some more fluffy shit to, like, draw people to the website, so.
So have you heard of Sturgeon's Law?
I don't know.
It's a simple one. It just says 90% of everything is crap. And I think it, maybe that's just what I should invoke for that question as much as anything. But, I mean, even with a list article, a lot of those are damned entertaining. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. They're the 50 shades of gray of internet content.
There you go.
We all pretend like we hate clickbaiting headlines and articles, but we read them.
You have to read 12 tweets about Black Lives Matter, right, so that you can read like an actual good article about Black Lives Matter.
Well, yeah, or like the 10 racist things that got said on Instagram today. Like, that's worth educating yourself on, probably.
Yeah, some of those clickbait articles are good.
But to feel superior, if nothing else.
And, speaking of, like, listicles, like, you know, Cracked is, like, the
so
king
popular
of that, but, they also have their share of, like, dumb fucking lists.
Oh, yeah.
But some of their lists are fabulous.
They have, like, a real educational goal that's part of what they do. And obviously not every article lives up to that, but probably most definitely, I would say definitely every week and even most days probably, they have one article that has like some decent historical or scientific information in it.
Yeah, I was poking around there and I discovered a series they do where they talk to people.
Oh, those are great. Yeah.
Who usually are like remain anonymous, who were like in create like five things you didn't know about being an inmate, and then they'll talk to someone mm-hmm. who's like an inmate in a federal prison, and like those are really interesting.
Or I was reading one about wastewater management the other day that I turned out to be just fascinated by.
Yeah.
I was like, who would have thought sewage was such an interesting topic?
Yeah.
So, what about the revenue models for online publishing? There's kind of like the paywall thing, I guess, for certain publications. You know, the New York Times, you pay X dollars, you get access to everything. Versus, I guess, the other one that I know of would be the more ad-based revenue thing. Hey, lots of people come here, we have ads. That's the downside to Cracked. If you use ad blocking software, it runs the number of things being blocked into like the thousands in 2 days. But like, is there a third model I don't know of? Does anyone figured out which of these two things works better? It looks like if you're high traffic, probably the ads, but maybe if you're the New Yorker, that's not a direction you want to go.
Yeah, so there's not like a super interesting answer to this question because it's mostly just like, yeah, that's
yep, those are the two. Fair enough.
We talked about it in my EPUB class, and basically, I mean, you should meet my professor. He's super salty. Maybe I could like convince him to be on the podcast sometime.
Oh yeah.
But he's basically said like, publishers, like one of the things about being online is, I mean, I guess the internet's been around for a while, but like publications being online and making money online actually haven't been around for terribly long. And so people just haven't really figured out like interesting or different ways to do things. They're just like, oh yeah, ads. Okay. Yeah, let's do ads. And just haven't really like figured out a different or interesting way to do stuff. So it's just something like we don't necessarily do that well, but can't really like figure out a different way to do it. Because like ads don't even necessarily make you that much money. Yeah, the paywall thing, although depending on like who you are, the paywall thing could like super piss people off.
Yeah, right.
Because we're so used to free content now, you're like, I can pay to read this shit. even the New York Times lets you read 10 free articles a month.
Yeah, they do.
So yeah, I would say, like, that's pretty much it.
Fair enough.
publishers, like, in particular, haven't really, like, bothered to try and get creative, so, yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, well, I guess there's the donation model, too, but that's...
Yeah.
Probably not something that, you know, the New York Times would be interested in, for example.
Right. That's good for, like, for smaller projects. Like...
You need to have a dedicated fan base for that.
Yeah, or, like, that's been a popular thing for artists. Like, the Patreon thing, uh-huh. where it's like, oh, if you're, like, my patron, then you get, like... You'll get something for it. Sort of thing. So, right. like, I'll send you a drawing or whatever, and then, like, you'll get to see updates on what I'm working on, so you can, like, ensure that your money is going toward whatever. But I don't really know how feasible that is for, like, a big publication, because businesses can't really necessarily... Like, can you please give us money?
they definitely like to lock you in before they give you the thing.
Yeah.
Does the difficulty, you know, like the, a freelance writer certainly wouldn't have nearly as much opportunity to get a column picked up in a bunch of newspapers some week, like they would have a couple decades ago. The online thing, because no one really knows how to make it pay the way it seems like it ought to, I'm guessing the rates probably aren't fantastic. Is it tougher to pay writers for their work now, especially since there are lots of bloggers out there who are, unfortunately for writers who want to get paid, there are a lot of bloggers out there who are writing, like, smart things that are worth reading and are not getting paid?
So, if you're, like, a legitimate publication, you will be paying your writers for writing for you. And I don't really know if there's, like, if that amount has gone up or down. I just really don't know.
Right.
I was going to say, when I started thinking about, like, paying people, I was like, oh, yeah, places will totally pay you. And I was like, except if you write for Minerva.
Yeah, right.
We can't afford to pay you. We're actually, like, if we ever make money, like, our number one priority is to, like, pay the people who sure. write for us.
Well, you're a passion project still at this stage. You're still working on that.
Yeah. So it kind of depends. I think there are a couple things that kind of depend. It kind of depends on, like, the size of the publication that you're writing for. So, like, I wrote a little article for the Mizuma blog, and Kim was running it. And I think I got, like, $20 or $25 for it. And so she's like, yeah, I'm, like, excited that I can pay people, but it's not very much. And I was like, hey, you know, like, that's more than I usually make writing articles for things. I had a friend who recently wrote an article for that she pitched to Slate, and she got about $100 for it. Mm. And we asked if that was... like, the average, and she said, like, she wasn't 100% sure, but she was, like, pretty sure, like, that sounded about right, and she said it might depend on, like, the section you're writing for, so if you're writing an article for, like, the front page, you might make more than if you're writing for whatever.
Right.
And then one of the other things that goes on is, if you're a freelancer, the good news, I guess the good news and the bad news is that, like, places get tons of pitches and, like, most of, like, a lot of them are just total shit and you're right. like, get out of here. But if you know how to write a pitch and you're a competent human, that means that, like, they'll see yours and be like, oh, thank God. and if a magazine works with you and you're good and you turn your shit in on time and you're easy to work with, then they will pick up articles you want to write for them again and again and again. And if they have an idea for an article and, like, you've written for them a bunch of times, they might even just, like, contact you and be like, hey, you want to write this thing? So, like, if you build relationships, you can build relationships with magazines as a freelancer and, like, get pulled on board. But that being said, you're never gonna make a ton of money freelance writing, probably, even if you're getting pretty steady work.
I guess the flip side to that, now, if you're an insanely prolific writer who is also good, I guess there are a lot more places to pitch to. So you can pitch to 50 places that are going to pay you $50 for an article instead of pitching to 3 places that'll pay you, I don't know, newspapers probably didn't pay that well back in the day, but I don't know, 10 cents a word or whatever the rate used to be.
Right, yeah, and some places might pay you per word, although on the internet, probably I'm assuming the model is X amount per article as opposed to per word.
Or I suggested in the outline 1% of your soul per click.
Yeah. I think some people probably do.
I guess the secret is to get enough of your pitches picked up that some place makes you a staff writer, and then you can just write listicles all day long every day.
Yeah, and that's kind of I think that's probably, when you ask if it makes it difficult to pay writers, I would say it's not difficult to pay freelance writers, it's more difficult to have a large team of staff writers.
Right.
Most places can't afford to pay salaries for a bunch of people, so they're more likely to only keep a couple staff writers and then pay a bunch of freelancers, as opposed to having a big team of staff writers and relying on them. So I guess that is the difficulty, is that it's difficult to hire and maintain staff writers as opposed to paying freelancers.
Yeah, having a big staff when your revenue model is kind of iffy is a problem.
Yeah.
So last couple questions, I guess. These are kind of the safety net questions. So safety net question number one, is there anything that you think is interesting that people inside of the industry are talking about that those of us outside of publishing haven't really heard about? Basically, what should I have asked about that I didn't have the knowledge to ask about? And I guess part two of that question is kind of what's on the horizon? What's coming soon that we might be interested in?
Yeah, so I kind of wrote a list of stuff out earlier, and I've touched on some of them already. One of the big things is the unpaid internships. A lot of publishers are just oh yeah, you pay your dues, you do your unpaid internship, and then a lot of people are this is nonsense. But it was something we were talking about earlier, how the profit margins are really small, so it's difficult for publishers to justify, or to say it's difficult for them to pay someone because they don't necessarily have the budget for it. But interns are often very helpful. A lot of publishers actually find employees based on their intern pool. Candlewick, the children's publisher I interned for, basically exclusively hires past interns. So I mean, the idea is that if you work for them, you might not be paid for the first 3 months, but then they might hire you, which is cool. So the thing with internships is, it's, I guess the idea is that you're building connections and your network, so that you can get hired somewhere.
Sure. I mean that's definitely something that a lot of industries are talking about right now, I think.
Yeah.
The idea of the unpaid labor in general. I don't know. I guess there are probably, I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head, but there are some places that have unpaid internships that you don't even get class credit for, I gather.
Yeah, there are.
That seems a little sketchy to me.
Yeah, most internships worth their salt will be like, well, we're unpaid. But the thing that I never took class credit for an internship because I was like, I'm not paying the school $4,600 to like not get paid to do work.
That's a fair point.
What nonsense is that?
At $400 plus whatever fees a credit hour.
Yeah.
Like, what do I really want to do?
But that does lend them some legitimacy when they're like, well, you can get class credit for it. And you're like, well, at least it's not going to be, like, a worthless internship.
Right.
And I think that's, like, one of the problems is that sometimes you kind of, like, take a chance on internships that end up possibly being kind of worthless and not helping you. So, I haven't really run into those in publishing. Like, I've never talked to anyone who had an internship that they were just like, that was completely worthless. I learned nothing. It's right. Not going to help me at all. But that's definitely a thing. And that's related to what I was talking about earlier, is how publishers are all located in big cities. And so unpaid internships feel like a double, like, nut punch. One of the things I actually discussed with one of my professors was, he said, I really don't understand why publishers, like, every publisher doesn't just move to, like, Indianapolis and, like, you know, like, a city that's actually makes sense for the amount of money. Like, we don't make very much money, but if you're living off of a publishing salary of $40,000 a year and you're living in the Midwest, like, you're doing fine.
That's right. Move to Kansas City, publishers.
Yeah, exactly.
It's affordable, like, here.
I don't know, I'm just going to disclose my salary information, whatever. When I worked in Kansas City, I was making a little more, like, $31,000 a year, which was fine. Like, I was super comfortable. I mean, I didn't have any kids or anything, but I was, like, super comfortable on that. And then I moved to Boston, and, like, starting salaries in the publishing industry are, like, 30 to 35, kind of depending on, like, the place and the job and all that stuff. And here, 30,000 feels like an outrageous beginning salary. I'm like, that is, like, not enough to do anything. That's like you're paying half your salary towards your rent. Like, what the fuck are you doing to me? My professor and I had this big conversation about how all publishers should just move to the Midwest and then just force, like, everyone to come to them, and then all of their employees will be really happy because they can afford, like, houses and stuff.
Well, I assume after hearing this podcast, the publishers will begin a mass exodus to the Midwest.
Post-haste.
Like, oh shit, Gab says we gotta move.
I'm just going to talk about, I think, like, two other things so I don't talk forever.
Okay.
So one of them is, one of the big changes in publishing is how you even get into the industry in the first place.
Okay.
So, I just thought of another thing.
Well, Gab, did you leave some room for me to talk about Renaissance Music Publishing?
It's kind of related to what I'm going to talk about. I'll merge them into one. So the way you used to get into publishing is you would basically, like find some internship somewhere, and they would, like, hire you because you were, like, a good English major, and then hopefully, like, one of your supervisors in your internship would kind of start acting as your mentor and, like, help you get a job and, like, so kind of, like, get your foot in the door. But the way the publishing industry has changed is because of these degrees and stuff. Publishers really like people coming in to be a lot more, like, skilled and knowledgeable. So, like, you used to be able to get these entry-level jobs without really any experience, and now, like, they won't even consider you unless you already know, like, the Adobe suite, and you have two internships under your belt, and you know, like, so, like, the standards have changed a lot, and, like, educational programs, like my program, give you all those, like, because they've been giving people those skills, and publishers are like, man, this is really cool when we hire someone, and, like, we don't have to worry about teaching them all this shit. So it's kind of becoming more, it's still very, like, knowing people gets you places, sure. But going to school and getting those skills is, like, way more likely to help you get your foot in the door than it used to be. And so there's, like, kind of this change going on where some of the older people in publishing are like, I don't see why people feel like they have to get these degrees. Like, back in my day, I just kind of, like, tripped and, like, fell into an editing job.
Right.
And, like, that doesn't really happen anymore.
In the 1980s, I could just put on a suit, walk through the door of any large business, building and say, I am a white male, give me a good job.
Yeah, basically. I don't know what these not white, not males are. Well, that's kind of, like, hand in hand with the other thing I was going to talk about. It's just like old school versus this new school thing going on. So, like, one of the other things is, there's, like, this kind of philosophical question of, like, is publishing here to teach you the skills you need to go into the industry? Or is it here to also teach you about, like, the history and the philosophy and, like, the literature?
Which I know you're into those things, because those are kind of your things before you... like, that was, yeah, your undergraduate background, basically.
Yeah, yeah. But I went to grad school to, like, learn how to do shit so I could get a job.
Right.
But it's kind of like this, like, what exactly should a publishing degree be? Because there's this, like, fair point that editors traditionally have had, like, a really solid understanding of, like, the history of literature. Mm. And, like, you kind of have to be able to work off of this body of, like, if you're acquiring books and editing books, like, hopefully you've read a lot of books and know how they work and have this, like, deep understanding. But then at the same time, like, should you make kids in a publishing course, and this is not a problem with grad students, but, like, it's a debate with the undergrad students at Emerson, should you make them take 5 literature courses, or should you lower that requirement to 2 lit courses and allow them to take more of, like, the practical skills classes? And, like, where exactly do you draw the line? And it's, like, that's a thing I think that people are, like, trying to figure out.
I guess I assumed that editors were still English majors.
So, pretty much everyone in my program was an English major, but I think the difference is that there are now there's an undergraduate publishing degree at Emerson.
Okay.
And so, it's right now, it's kind of like a combination English/publishing major, but they're trying to figure out, should they just make, like, a strict publishing undergraduate major where you don't have to do all the English majory stuff? And if you don't have to do all the English majory stuff, are you, like, a worthy addition to the publishing field?
Right.
Yeah. I had a professor who made a really good point to me where he said, like, you know, one of the reasons you get, like, assigned work and jobs and promotions in publishing is if, like, the higher-ups, if, like, you can speak their language. And he's like, so even though, like, it might not be useful to, like, know how to make puns about the Odyssey in the real world, you might make an Odyssey pun to, like, an editor, and he'll be like, you're great, and, like, the next time he wants to, like, assign extra work to someone, he'll, like, think of you, because he's like, oh, that person, they really know how to make jokes about Homer or whatever.
That sure was an awesome joke about Odysseus's bowstring or whatever.
So he was, like, saying there's, like, still value in, like, that literary nerddom, because if you can, like, get in with the... Because everyone who works in publishing, like, obviously loves books.
It'd be weird if they didn't.
It would be really weird if they didn't. Thank God I have not yet met a person in my programs who's like, I don't really read. I'd be like, what are you doing here? So, like, I mean, yeah, there's the argument of, like, helping you fit into the social structure of the industry. So, the culture. Yeah.
All right.
I have, like, so much other stuff, but I'm just going to stop talking.
Well, we can always save it for later. Well, here, how about this? Safety net question number two. So as opposed to things being talked about in your classes and in your industry, do you have any personal publishing-related hobby horses? Do you want to throw one more thing out there before we wrap up?
This is not related to my, like, personal whatever, but I did think of a hilarious example of the reason you should have diversity and inclusion experts look at your stuff.
Let's do it.
So, textbook publishing, which, by the way, is mostly based out of Texas, which
I've heard that.
Horrible. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there was a history textbook that was published, and a mother was, like, helping her. I don't know if she was, like, just flipping through it or she's helping her kid or, like, whatever. But anyway, she, like, turns to this page, and there's a caption. It's talking about, like, the Atlantic slave trade and how, like, all these slaves got, like, sent to the Americas and all this stuff. But the caption says, like, over the course of however many years, thousands of workers were sent to the United States to blah, 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 blah. And the mother was like, excuse me, calling them workers that they were, like, getting paid and getting jobs and, like...
I was going to comment on that. I'm glad that's where it was going.
Yeah. So she posted this thing and was like, your caption about slavery does not use the word slaves. Like, what are you doing? And so there was, like, this huge, like, blow up, like, pushback on the publisher, which in that case I was like, yeah, that was stupid.
Yeah, guys. You earned that one, guys.
Yeah, I was like, oh, man. So, you know, words do matter. That's why editors and copy editors are important, and it's always important to have, like, I actually think hiring, like, diversity and inclusion experts might not be a bad idea for, like, the industry as a whole, just to avoid things like that. There was, like, this huge blow-up recently in publishing. I actually need to read more about it, but I don't remember who the publisher was, but they were going to publish this book. It was called A Birthday Cake for George Washington, and it was about George Washington's main cook, who was a slave, and how, like, George's birthday was coming up, and they wanted to make him this cake, and, like, he needed certain ingredients, and he was, like, sending his daughter out to go get ingredients, and... blah, blah. And at the end, they, like, bake this awesome big cake, and they're, like, super proud of it. But they got a ton of pushback because a lot of people thought the way it was portraying slavery, like, these slaves, like were really happy and, like, were, like... It basically, people thought it was, like, kind of putting this rosy tint on slavery to be like, look how happy and productive these slaves were. As opposed to being like, hey, like, they were still slaves. And so, like, there was this, like, big debate, and a lot of people just kind of heard about it and got pissed, and they ended up, like, recalling the books. But then I interestingly found out later that the person who wrote it and the person who illustrated it were, like, non-white people who've, like, written a lot of books on, like, diverse issues and stuff before. And so then there was this big conversation of, like, were people, like, correct in their outrage over this book? And, like, I don't know. It was really interesting. So those are, like, some of the things that are on people's minds.
All right. So if you have any comments, questions, etc. about what you just listened to, then you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can find us on Twitter. You can tweet Ben and tell him how fat and stupid he is, at Novel Ideas Pod. And you can contact me and tell me how much funnier I am than Ben at Classic Sum Up.
Yeah, in fact, all tweets to both of us should be solely regarding those two subjects. any other content, please direct to either the website or to MinervaMag.com if you found it through there. You can leave comments there. In fact, you should. We need more comments.
Yeah, definitely.
And we're also on iTunes still. And I guess you can leave comments there, though I'll never see them.
You can leave ratings and reviews. I looked at our ratings and reviews, but I'm pretty sure no one's left a rating or review in, like, 2 years.
Gabs, we're one of the longest-running book podcasts out there.
It's very true, actually.
I discovered there's another one, though, by Nate Cordry, and they actually have listeners. I'm jealous.
Those dicks.
I know, bastards.
You should email them and be like, hey, motherfucker.
We have over 100 episodes. Look.
I don't care. I did realize the other day, I hopped on, like, the On This Day function on Facebook, which just shows you, like, stuff that happened in previous years on this day. And I found our very first, when I posted about the Hunger Games, our very first episode.
All right.
All the way back in, like, March of 2012. And I was like, oh my God, we've been doing this podcast for 4 years.
So far, have yet to derive a single benefit from it.
Our listener audience is, like, not grown since month three, but, you know.
Like I always say, this is a purely self-indulgent project, and we do, and we make no apologies and make no attempt to hide it.
We have sunk literally hundreds of hours into this.
So true.
And never made a single dime. It's incredible.
Yeah, also, we've been recording for a long time, and we're pretty slap happy, so I think we're going to go ahead and wrap up, and that'll be all for this time, and we'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone!